He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, WGBH 89.7. Thank you for tuning in.
Hey, Marjorie, your piece, front page of Boston Herald today about that convicted rapist, Gary Irving, was great. I have one question for you that I don't quite get.
What?
The guy was convicted of three rapes in the summer of 1978.
Three different young women.
Right.
He was testified.
18 years old.
Right.
While he's about to go into a sentencing hearing, he escapes. He spends 34 years, whatever, in Maine. The only question I have that I don't quite understand, why was the guy convicted of three violent rapes? Why was he not in jail pending his sentencing? Why was he out,
Jim,
free to escape to Maine for 3 decades?
That's an excellent question.
And what's the answer?
Well, we don't have the answer. The judge who did it is no longer with us. But the argument he gave at the time was, even though, and this is how it usually happens, you were convicted of a serious crime, a rape, a manslaughter, a murder.
Three rapes.
The cuffs are on your hands,
right,
and you
right.
were led off to jail. For some bizarre reason, the family of one of the survivors of this rape thinks it was because the kid was connected. His father was an auxiliary cop.
The rapist was connected.
Right. But the judge in the case said, I'll give you some time to get your affairs in order, go home and get your affairs in order, come back for your sentencing. And the prosecutor was speechless. Everybody was speechless, not to mention the families who've just been through this horrible ordeal of a rape trial. You know, to say I'm worked up into a fever pitch about some of the, with righteous indignation about some of the stories in the news today that we're going to talk about is an understatement, John. I'm beside myself.
Well, your piece is great. Front page of the Boston Herald. But starting up, joining us is one of the stars of the hit new political drama, House of Cards. Listen to this stirring performance.
Shelley Barnes of the Washington Herald, quoting a source close to the president.
That, of course, as you recognize, the voice of noted method actor and sometime journalist, CNN's John King. John, that was truly brilliant. Brilliant.
You know, I need a plan B, guys. Menino retired early on me, so I can't be mayor. And I don't know how long this journalism thing's going to work out. So, you know, you always got to work on a plan B. Red Sox haven't called. And so, yeah, I got to try acting, I guess.
It was beautiful.
Well, at the risk of sounding superficial, John King, you're a very handsome guy. I think acting could fit right nicely into your whole wheelhouse.
At the moment, superficial treats you just.
Okay. So, John, every week we ask you about your update on, you know, what's Congress doing in terms of gun control legislation and immigration reform. So let's start with guns. You know, post-Newtown, it seems as though the furor that we saw from the public about demanding some kind of reasonable gun control is kind of tamped down. Do you see anything happening in Washington, at least about background checks? I mean, I think 90% of the public supports background checks.
And yet, 90% of the public and most Republicans are open to at least more robust background checks. And yet, at this moment, even that is a question mark. If you made me make a bet, I would bet that more robust background checks do pass the Congress this year. Not the universal background checks the president is looking for, something closer to the Virginia law that was passed after Virginia Tech during the Bush administration. But even that is in peril. And it's not just Republicans. People are going to say it's Republicans. In the House, it's conservative Republicans who aren't, most of them aren't open to changing anything. Some are willing to look. Remember, Eric Cantor supported the changes in the Virginia law, his home state. He's the majority leader. So he's open to some things. But one of the president's biggest problems is Democrats in his own party who are on the ballot statewide in 2014 who are saying, no, thank you, Mr. President. So despite the tragedy, the math, if you will, you know, how many people have raised their hands saying, I've been an opponent of any gun control in the past, but I'm willing to change my mind or I'm willing to at least think about it? Very few hands have gone up. The math simply has not changed. And so you won't get an assault weapons ban. You most likely won't get a ban on these big magazine clips. And even the universal background checks is in jeopardy, although I think a version of that can be salvaged.
You know, in the last 24 hours, pretty dramatic gun control legislation, John, has passed in Connecticut. But one piece of it, it seems to me, feeds the argument that the anti-gun control people in Washington have used. When those who oppose universal background checks say it's going to lead, it's a slippery slope, it leads to some firearm registry database that we don't want. Well, in Connecticut, as you know, they ban future sales of high-capacity magazines, but they go on. It's not a complete ban, just future sales. However, if you currently own a high-capacity magazine, it would require registration of that magazine. Doesn't that feed the argument that anti-gun control people have been making vis-a-vis universal background checks?
And And listen, a lot of people simply flat out reject their argument, saying these things kill people, so why can't the government keep track of them? But that is an argument that has been used quite persuasively by people who say, and this is a fact. I mean, the people who are strong proponents of gun control, sometimes on both sides, so we have extremes on both sides that won't take a deep breath and respect the other person's view. You know, 99.99% of people who have these weapons, even weapons that, you know, some people might think are ridiculous and unnecessary, military only, they shouldn't be allowed in the home. 99.999, and I could go on, percent of these people are law-abiding citizens. And so they do feel, and if you get outside of urban America and get into rural and small-town America, it's a cultural question. They feel their rights are being infringed by the government, and they have a general skepticism of any government involvement to begin with.
And there's talk, Mark Kelly, who is the husband, former astronaut, obviously, of Gabby Giffords, in the last 24 hours has been warning, maybe that's a poor choice of words, but I'll use it anyway, warning Republican senators against filibustering Senate gun control legislation. Is that about to happen? Are there actually senators who are going to try to filibuster the whole thing if there's any move at all over there?
There are a handful who have reserved their right to filibuster anything, including more robust background checks. Now, how much of that is bluster right now and how much of it will play out? How much of it would Republican leader Mitch McConnell maybe come to try to pressure some of his colleagues if it comes to that, if he decides, okay, we've got a bill here that, you know, even if the NRA is objecting, not objecting that forcefully to expand a background check. So we need to see the final print. Some of that bluster now and that threat now of a filibuster is meant to, you know, influence the negotiations and influence the writing of any legislation. But that's why I said there is a majority support for more robust background checks. But that doesn't mean it will pass. Majority support means nothing when it comes to the United States Senate. You need 60. And the question is, you know, will enough Republicans support, if the Democrats bring that to the floor, number one, some Republicans will filibuster just to force the Democrats to vote on it, because then you have that vote against them in the 2014 elections if they're from a conservative state. And the question is, can you get to 60? My guess is if it's more robust background checks only, you could probably get to 60 and break a filibuster, but somebody might pull that move just to get that vote on the record.
We're talking to CNN's John King. We did our weekly update. Okay, thank you very much, John, on the state of gun control. Let's move on to immigration now. We've heard conflicting things this week. New York Senator Chuck Schumer says that they're very close to a deal down there. Florida Senator Marco Rubio says that that's premature. They're not close to a deal. What's the truth?
Both. That's how Washington works. You can have. Sometimes you are entitled to your own facts in Washington. So they're both. They're both right in the sense that Senator Rubio is part of the negotiations where he is in general agreement with his gang of eight, group of eight colleagues. But Senator Rubio's point is we can't just bring this to the floor. And part of that is because whether he's running again for re-election in his home state of Florida or whether he's running for the next Republican presidential nomination, you know, he supports a path to citizenship, but he knows a good number of people in his own party will oppose him on that. And if they take the health care route, print a 2,000-page bill and try to pass it in a blank, he knows he'll get flack from the conservative base beyond the policy objections. He'll get flack for rushing it. And part of it is his Tea Party affinity, which is that, you know, we should have committee hearings. We should air these things out. That Congress shouldn't cut deals in back rooms and then pass them before people can read the legislation. So Senator Rubio is hitting the go slow button here. He has not hit the stop button yet. And so I still think you'll see progress on this one. And there are the votes in the Senate to get a pretty good, big majority for legislation that, among other things, has a new guest worker program and a path to citizenship. But my big giant question mark is, will the conservative House pass a path to citizenship? I'm not so sure. They may pass a path to legal status, short of citizenship. Well, you can stay, you can get a green card, you can pay a penalty, and you can work if you came here illegally. So then what happens? Does the president tell the Senate to compromise and just have a path to legal status? Or does the president say, no, I want citizenship, and if I can't get it, we'll have no legislation, and they'll take that into the 2014 and the 2016 election cycle. So for all the progress on immigration, for all the emerging consensus on immigration, there's not enough yet to get the House on the record for citizenship. And so this may become another political issue and not a policy advancement, but big question mark.
And I'm guessing that the emerging consensus on the Republican side is from those who are not House members coming from places where their reelection, were they to take a progressive stance on immigration, is guaranteed to fail.
You don't have to listen to Jim and Marjorie and John King or anybody else. Pick up a census report. Go online to census.gov. And all, you know, it used to be that, you know, in parts of America, this debate, people said, what? You know, because it was traditional. Everywhere in America is becoming more brown. And look, there are a lot of conservative Latinos who don't like illegal immigration, who play by the rules and don't like people who cheat. But then you have the reality of you have 11, 12, pick your number, million people here. As Michael Bloomberg says, you know, you don't have the money to round them up and throw them out, and what would happen to the economy. So something has to be done. The question is, and more Republicans now realize, either whether it's for political reasons, as in our party's getting killed by the growing Latino vote, or for policy reasons, so they just think it's the right thing to do, or a little bit of both. God forbid you have, you know, good policy makes good politics. There is a growing consensus, but the big question of citizenship is still a huge trigger for a lot of conservatives who say, no, that's amnesty. And I'm not going to support that. So I don't know. I don't know that the math. Let me put it more definitively. The math is not there right now to get citizenship through the House. That doesn't mean you can't change it. If you get a big, huge Senate vote, if the Chamber of Commerce and other people work the Republicans, they might be able to get there with the help of Democrats. But it's not there right now.
Hey, John. I don't know if you're a betting man or not, but I'm going to ask you to lay some odds here to conclude our weekly gun and immigration update from Washington. What you seem to be saying is the most likely outcome, I know you correct me if I'm wrong, is change on the margins. On gun control, it may be some background check thing relating to mental illness, but not universal. And on immigration, it may stop short of a pathway to citizenship. If you had a bet now on what the outcome is that where you'd put your money?
Definitely on gun control, change on the margins, more robust background checks. On immigration, I think it's still a coin toss as to whether you can get momentum enough to get citizenship, and otherwise the president will state the defining question. Does he take path to legal status and say, I'll come back later for citizenship, or does he take the issue into 2014 and 2016? And I can tell you the political consultants would say, take the issue, don't take the compromise.
We're talking with John King from CNN. John, great week in Washington last week with the United States Supreme Court considering both the Prop 8 question out in California and the DOMA, the federal law preventing gay couples from getting benefits, even in states like Massachusetts, federal benefits, that is. You know, you always hear that the Supreme Court is above politics because they're appointed for life, yada, yada, yada. But now you get the sense.
He's laughing if you can't hear at home. Go ahead.
Well, don't hear it. Just don't believe it.
Well, you know, if you weren't suspicious before with Bush versus Gore and, you know, and Obamacare and stuff, you get a real sense that from the questions last week that they're hinting at striking down DOMA. So, yeah, I guess by your laugh, you think that they're up to their eye teeth in politics, even though they claim otherwise.
Well, everything in life is politics, right? The Red Sox and the Nationals are undefeated today, so that's my World Series. Let's just call the season off. Everything in life is play to your home team. And if you look at the arguments by smart Supreme, I was not there, but if you look at the articles written by smart Supreme Court watchers, they say it's pretty clear to them that the conservatives decided to take these cases because they thought this is their last chance, that the demographics of the court are changing, that the mood in the country is changing, and, you know, one of these justices could retire soon, and Obama's still president for a couple more years, that the justices thought that, you know, this is their moment to plant the conservative flag, the anti-same-sex marriage or anti-same-sex benefits, one more time, to get the at least more conservative ruling out of the court. Now, you also could get the sense from some of the questioning, you know, that they're not sure. But, you know, not that they think they're going to win if you're Antonin Scalia, you know, or Justice Alito. Not that you're sure you're going to win, but you think you have a better chance now than you will in 2 years or 4 years as these cases make their way through the courts. So, of course, that's politics. Let's have this decision now where I think I have a slightly stronger argument. Is it bad politics? Is the court supposed to work some other way? I mean, I think it's human nature.
Yeah, but my sense of this, John, I don't think we've spoken, well, we haven't because we didn't speak to you last week, is that the DOMA thing, the tea leaves suggest that Kennedy is going to go with a liberal majority and at least repeal the provision that bans these benefits. But on Proposition 8, it seems to me that even the Scalias of the world who don't support gay marriage don't want to be seen as being on the wrong side of history when 3 or 5 or 8 years from now, there is a ruling from the Supreme Court that the Constitution guarantees people a right to marry whomever they want. So that would argue that ultimately they make a decision that's narrow that only applies to California. Isn't that a fair assumption?
They could try to make the most narrow decision possible. I think you're dead right on the benefits question. I do think we're going to see progress. Let's call it progress in that regard. And on the marriage question, look, there's a lowercase c conservative way out of this, which is to go to the Dick Cheney position, which is marriage is one of those things that is left to the states. Let states decide it. Mm-hmm. And you don't need a federal policy. Now, will advocates of same-sex marriage, as they start to make progress, push for national, making the arguments about, you know, people who move in a global economy and, you know, big national, they'll make those arguments. But the court could come out now and say, you know, that is the Dick Cheney conservative, you know, George W. Bush wanted the constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. Dick Cheney said, no, this should be done at the state level. That is a conservative ruling, a constitutional constructionist would say the founding fathers wanted those decisions made by the states.
And if they want the decision made for the states, then why would all the conservatives then subsequently not vote to make it a 9-0 clean sweep to repeal DOMA, saying if a state wants to allow you to marry a person of the same sex, then we're not going to stand in the way of you getting federal benefits? Isn't that the natural extension of what you're saying?
It would be. I think you could make a rational, logical case for that extension.
However,
I would say the history of our great republic is that, you know, these things do not always go in a straight line.
Yeah.
Okay,
and
hey, Joe.
Some of this is hard. I'm not going to take sides here. Some of this is hard. It's hard for people because of religious faith. It's hard for people. There's a huge age demographic difference on these questions, and so some of it's hard. And whether it's civil rights, whether it's women's rights, now whether it's, you know, same-sex couples and their rights, these things don't often go in straight lines. I would say this one is moving at a faster pace. Remember, 2004, George W. Bush ended every campaign speech on the constitutional amendment question. It was a big Republican turnout. Mm-hmm. Just 8 years later, a Democratic president, in his inaugural address, is talking about the civil rights for same-sex couples in America.
Yeah, that's a great point.
This arc is moving very fast in terms of the context of history.
Okay, before we leave, we learned about 15 minutes ago that you're obviously a fine actor. We've also known for years you're the biggest Red Sox fan in America. In about an hour, the chief operating officer, Sam Kennedy, the Red Sox, is going to join us, John King, and he's going to talk about this program I'm sure you've read about to try to get more fannies in the seat in April. 2-for-1 hot dogs, cheap beer, free meals for kids. What do you want us to tell Sam Kennedy on your behalf, John?
The cheaper beer thing is a brilliant idea. The kids can fend for themselves.
Yeah.
John King from CNN. We will pass those words along to Sam Kennedy in about an hour. John, great to talk to you. Talk to you again next Tuesday.
Thanks, John. So in January, Deval Patrick rolled out this proposal for his 2014 budget. Education topped his list as a major priority. Well, I don't know that the kids are going to get that major priority based on what happened this morning. Up next, Secretary of Education Matt Malone will talk to us about the new budget, education reform. We'll take all your questions next on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Today, right now, actually, is another in our series of Ask Thee. Today, it's the new Secretary of Education, former superintendent of the Brockton Schools, Matt Malone. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Well, thank you for having me today. It's exciting to be here.
Well, it's our pleasure.
It is great to be here, but we got kind of disappointing news, which you probably already heard. We got the headline from the State House News. Plan snubs Patrick on income tax expansion plans for education funding. If people don't know this, the governor wanted close to $2 billion of new money, new taxes, including a higher income tax to fund transportation and to fund education. Now we're hearing that all we're going to get is $500 million. Most of that's going to go to transportation, not to education. So, Commissioner, this is not a good thing for you.
We're going to take our time and digest what the House put forward today. This is not over until it's over. We're in this fight. This is not about politics. This is not about personality. This is not about anything beyond what's right for young people. And this investment in education is what we're advocating for. We're very concerned about making sure that we stay on the table. Today's turn of events, of course, are concerning, but the good people at the State House, they'll make the right decision over the next few weeks and as we work through this budget process.
And I know there's a process, and actually Matt Murphy from the State House News Service wrote, quote, from this is from Terry Murray, the Senate president, any additional spending on education programs would be considered during normal budget deliberation. So it's not end of the line, but you have to be pretty depressed. I mean, the governor's advocated big time for this. You have been
depressed.
Going all over the place.
He looks very depressed.
Advocating for this. This is obviously, it's not a good start in terms of the legislative response to this proposal. Is it, Matt Malone?
I've been an underdog my entire life, and I haven't given up, and I'm still here, and I'm going to keep fighting for kids. I travel this entire Commonwealth talking to good people who understand the need to invest in early childhood, in K-12, in higher ed, about closing gaps, increasing opportunities. And those voices will continue to be heard over the next few days up at the House. And I think the good people who we've elected to represent us will do the right thing.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Secretary of Education is with us, Matt Malone. If you have any questions about the governor's plan, about what happened this morning in the legislature, or about public education in general, Secretary Malone is here for you. 877-301-8970.
Now, Secretary Malone, you don't know us, but I knew you were the superintendent of the Brockton Public Schools. I went to public schools in Fall River. Brockton and Fall River have a lot in common. Jim is in the tank with the Massachusetts Teachers Association.
I wouldn't
so
put it that
never,
way.
Well, he is. What I wonder about, and you've seen the struggles of Brockton, poor town, a lot of immigration, just like Fall River. Nobody talks about, including Governor Patrick, and maybe you're a little bit different about this, real reform of the schools. He doesn't want to have any more charter schools, even though charter schools are showing some great successes. Doesn't want to do any kind of radical reform. To me, until you pay the best teachers a ton of money, like $200,000, and pay the bad teachers next to nothing, so they leave, and we get all a bunch of great teachers, nothing's going to change.
It's funny you say this. I've done two kinds of reform in my life. I've been a reformer my entire career. And quite frankly, I think the best reform I did was actually working in collaboration with the MTA and the city of Brockton. I mean, we've got great results. We're the only urban district without a level four school. We're the leading urban district in the Commonwealth.
What does that mean without a level four school?
That means we don't have any failing schools. We're doing this together in collaboration. We're also doing innovation through extended learning time, through real reforms around about how we teach and how we hold folks accountable. So I think there's a middle ground here. There's not, you know, sometimes I get frustrated. I tell you what I do get frustrated by. I get frustrated by people that think there's only one way to do something, and there's multiple ways. You know, the charter folks think their way is the best way. I think the district folks that are working with unions think their way is the best way, but I think it's a tandem, a collaboration, and I think charter schools are an important tool in the toolbox, but not the only tool
so
in the toolbox.
So what did you do in Brockton that made a big difference? What kind of reforms are you talking about?
I think what I call site-level school redesign. So that's getting at the cultures of schooling, the condition of schooling, culture, structure, and instruction by giving decisions to the field. So decentralizing, decreasing the footprint to allow for site-level decisions. But using Elmore, you know, from across the river in Harvard here, his whole theory of action around tight, loose coupling. When we get results, we give autonomy. When we get less results, we give more prescription.
So you mean the principal gets to run their school?
Well, great question. So it's a team. It's principals, teachers, there's parents involved. Mm-hmm. But really it's about allowing grade-level teams to be able to make decisions on the ground using data and immediately intervene when students aren't doing well.
Our number is 877-301-8970. That's the voice of Secretary of Education, relatively new Secretary of Education, Matt Malone, if you want to call him about anything relating to public schools, plus the governor's plan and the legislators' at least initial response. Matt, give us the Cliff Notes version. What were the selling points, according to you and the governor, of this whole investment thing on community colleges, early ed, whatever? Give us the quick version.
All right. So the governor's plan really targets three key areas: early childhood, K-12, and higher ed. It's about investing in early childhood to reduce proficiency gaps by the end of third grade. So the entire goal, if you will, the theory of action is to reduce gaps, both gaps in performance, but also gaps in opportunity. So by reducing gaps in performance, we're going to invest in early childhood, get at reading proficiency by the end of third grade, extend the time at the middle level, increase opportunities for four-year-olds in public school systems, align our high schools, our vocational schools, and our community colleges in a way that actually produce folks that have a skill to do something, and make college more affordable. The reforms that are happening at the higher ed level through the Vision Project are outstanding. It's about really 21st century education.
So let me tell you what my assessment of what's going on in Beacon Hill that you're confronting, and tell me where I'm wrong. I think I heard a piece of your interview with Emily Rooney last night, and I think you made a very good point. I hope I'm characterizing what you said well. We all drive under a bridge. It looks like it's fallen down, or under a tunnel. That's tangible. That's visceral. We get it. You don't get the value. It's an intellectual thing to try to understand how important early education spending is, et cetera. That's number one. Number two, I assume legislators are saying to you, we have the highest test scores in the country. If we have the highest test scores in the country, our education system is not imploding. We don't have money for this right now. What do you say to them, Matt Malone?
Right. So you're absolutely right that you can see the potholes in the road and the cracks in the bridges.
Of course I'm right. I'm quoting you. No wonder I'm right.
Right. But thank you. But what I think folks need to understand more fully is that, yes, Massachusetts leads the nation in student achievement. It's great. But still, we have only 37% of our African American kids are proficient in reading in third grade, only 36% of Latino kids. We feel strongly that, and research shows the test from Michigan, the assessment in Michigan, a research study from 1967 shows what the value of an investment in early childhood is. We've underfunded early childhood. So that the governor's proposals about aligning an early childhood system that's standards-based, that's rigorous, that has accountability metrics in it with our K-12 system, we think we'll be able to move the ball down the field to get more folks into college.
So why don't the legislators get this? They're not anti-education. They're not anti-kids. Why has there been a failure to connect your concepts and their decision-making?
They do get this because we've had great discussions with them across this Commonwealth. They understand it. It's very hard to find the architecture for them to raise the money to do it. And I just got to say this. I mean, what is the cost to live in a democracy such as ours? What is the cost? Taxes is a cost of our democracy. Veteran cemeteries is a cost of our democracy. We need to invest now in education because if we don't, 30 years from now, we're going to say, how come we're, last in the world in innovation?
Well, that's
the
great point. Jim always says the same thing all the time. Oh, we're the highest in the United States of America. But the United States of America is failing vis-a-vis the rest of the world. We used to be number one in education in K-12, and we're not anymore. And that's a big problem. But what about the early childhood? Because it seems to me that need is most acute in the poorer cities. And what about some kind of, the Brocktons, the Lawrences, the New Bedfords? What about piloting those kind of programs where the need is the greatest?
So the governor's proposal is $900 million. And within the governor's proposal, there are carve-outs for specific gateway city initiatives where we're actually going to target the gateway cities that have these needs. But think about this. We've asked for $900 million, and we're having a hard time convincing people. That's just for those cities. I mean, the pieces of this, it's not just for those cities, of course. It's early childhood fully, but those targeted investments – convincing folks across the state how important this is the mission we're on. People seem to understand it. It's just very hard for folks to say we're going to increase the income tax.
877-301-8970. That's the voice of the new Secretary of Education. His name is Matt Malone. Mark from Andover, you're on with the new Secretary. Good morning. Good afternoon, whatever it is.
Hi, Mark. Good morning. Jim and Marjorie, great job you're doing with the show.
Thank you kindly.
For Mr. Secretary, I heard you on Emily Rooney last night, was very impressed, and I wanted to ask you about there was an article in the Globe yesterday about the new pay proposal in Lawrence, a new ladder which would give a starting salary of $44,000 to a new recruit in Lawrence, then they would pass through a series of checkpoints, and within 5 or 10 years, they could be earning double that.
So what's your question? You want to know what he thinks about it?
He wants to know about the plan. He wants the details on the plan.
How about it,
Secretary? Mark, thank you very much for the call. What is that Lawrence plan that Mark was talking about?
So we've been talking for years about the outdated nature of the teacher pay scale. It's a salary lane. It's based on credits and years. In Lawrence, which is a level 5 system, it's a receivership, by the Commissioner of Education.
Big trouble.
They've put forward really an interesting, bold design to kind of do away with the old way of thinking about compensation and really professionalize the practice. So it offers more money for additional responsibility, for greater results, and for more professional practice. It will be interesting to see where this goes because, quite frankly, we've been talking about this for a long, long time.
You know, we have an email from Mary Beth who says that Matt's mother, Judy Malone Neville, was a great teacher in Newton South High School, the only teacher that really understood the kids in her class and saved Mary Beth by giving her a copy of Jane Eyre in high school.
That's pretty great.
Your mother was a great teacher. You don't come from Newton, do you?
I grew up in Newton Upper Falls.
You know, may I say something? You don't look like you grew up in Newton Upper Falls. You look like you could have been in the Golden Gloves in Brockton. You don't look like a Secretary of Education.
I always thought I was related to the Marcianos when I was in Brockton. But let me just tell you real quick. So my mother, I grew up in Newton Upper Falls, which is a working class community in the city of Newton, if you don't know it. But my mother was a teacher, and I'm an only child, and the kids in the neighborhood still talk about that. You know, the kids that needed that still talk about her making a difference. There was one point in my life my mother had a student that wasn't doing well in school, and she took him home. Next thing you know, I had a foster brother. And,
is that really
wow.
so?
Yeah. And it's, you know, the things we do when we understand the value of teachers having the impact of young people. So I always appreciate whoever wrote that saying.
Mary Beth.
That. Mary Beth, whoever you are. I don't even know the book you referenced, but I'm sure it was pretty good.
Hey, speaking of history, before we get back to the Kohl's, Secretary Malone, and again, our number is 877-301-8970. I want to read you a sort of a motto of a middle school in Massachusetts. Tell me what you think about it. Quote, trash is our enemy, homework is our friend. Is that, what does that do for you, Secretary Malone? Does that ring a bell or anything?
So when I hear that, I actually giggle inside. One of the greatest jobs I ever had was being an assistant principal in Duxbury, Massachusetts.
And one of our producers, Abby, was a student in the school when you were the middle school. But go ahead.
So I got to the school, and they weren't happy. They had 1,000 kids in the school, and they weren't happy with the school culture. They wanted, you know, so I got there, and I came from I came directly from teaching at the Burke High School in Boston.
That's a tough school.
And I got there, and I was like, this is your problem? These kids? And they were great kids. And they're like, people were like, you know, they're out of control. So I started this whole momentum that we were going to, if we had a clean school and we worked hard, everything else would take care of itself. So we started this mantra, and every day I'd come over the loudspeaker and I would say, trash is our enemy, homework is our friend. And we played kickball every single recess. And we started recess because being outside and moving around is so important.
Yeah.
We've lost that.
Hey, yeah,
Carla,
we have lost that. That's a great point we have.
Carla from Mattapoisett, you're on with Secretary Malone, Secretary of Education in Massachusetts. Welcome, Carla.
Thank you very much. I love that comment about the clean schools. I think that's very important, the environment they go to. I have a question about gifted education. When I left the Massachusetts 25 years ago, there was funding, and I just returned now, and there appears to be no funding for gifted. These kids aren't getting challenged. There's not much being left with the differentiating in the classroom because the teachers are being so driven by these test standards. And so these kids that are gifted or even twice exceptional special ed with high comprehension or poverty kids are not receiving the challenges they need. Is there any discussions happening on the state level for that?
Yes,
Carla, thank you.
There's always discussions about funding, but I mean, we found, quite frankly, that as a separate line item, it didn't have the value that it has is part of the overall operating cost of a system. So, for example, in Brockton, we have a tremendous gift and talented program that really matriculates all the way up through high school with advanced placement and international baccalaureate in one building. I know that several school systems do a great job of providing additional enrichment and support for students that are above grade level. I think that you know, one of the things in the governor's proposal is about this expanded learning time. That is a methodology to get at more deeper inquiry for
Is that
students.
The longer school day? Is that what you're talking
yes.
about? I was surprised. The Globe editorial today, lead editorial, was about the expanded school day. Only $5 million in this whole thing for an expanded school day? I mean, that sounds like short money. No?
Well, that's just in some schools. That's at least one middle school in at least every community that has 50% poverty or more. Look, if we had a gazillion dollars to do it everywhere, we would. It's a research-based practice that works.
You know, we've got an email from Parson, which may get to some of the problem you have pushing the higher taxes and more money for education. He says, listening to the new Secretary of Education, but I'm not buying it. I intern with the Department of Elementary and Secondary Ed. It's huge beyond reason. It is bloated. These are departments and departments and departments, tough economic times, et cetera. He's saying that the money needs to be reprioritized.
Great question. I think that, you know, this governor, this administration has been a leader of reform. We've cut 6,000 jobs out of state government. There's been cuts the last 8 years. So, you know, quite frankly, I don't agree with that person because superintendent for eight years, I cut positions. And we've all been downsizing through this recession. The good news is Massachusetts coming out of this recession. And we know historically that an investment in infrastructure and education at this right opportunity will continue to grow this economy and will be leading the country in recovery.
Let's go to Auburn, where Lorna is on the phone. She's on Boston Public Radio with Secretary Matt Malone. Hey, Lorna.
Hey, I'm a teacher in Massachusetts. I teach in the town, not an urban city. I teach in the town in central Massachusetts, and I find it kind of tiring. The teachers seem to be always targeted for more professional development, more professionalism, greater skills. You know, it really should be 100% toward the teachers and 100% toward the parents. The parents need skills, too, in order to help their students achieve in school, and studies have been done that document that parents who help their children in school, their children fare far much better than parents who don't.
Lorna, so just can we just leave it there because we're short on time? The parent issue, I think, is huge. I couldn't agree more with Lorna. When you go to a parent-teacher night at your school, you see some kids' parents are there, intimately involved. Others are either there, not there because they don't care. They have three jobs, whatever it is. How do you address that issue?
The strategy around the early childhood component is really linked around families and communities. So it's about going into the home, doing the child study, teaching parents how to understand what literacy means and provide those resources in the home. Those practices will get greater student achievement. The other area is around, you know, parenting, of course, is just through the modeling of good behaviors. But I also have to say there are some kids that don't have two parents who are responsible and respectful and able. So we have to love those kids twice as much because they need to hear it from people like my mother that your caller wrote about. But folks that take in district, that's what the role of the teacher is. And it's not the teacher needs to be the parent. What I'm saying is that we need to try extra hard to push to never accept anything less than one's best work because that's what true empathy is.
Secretary, one of the things that's going to confront you and the governor as of 11 o'clock this morning after this press conference is the reality is he's not getting anywhere near not only is he not getting new taxes for education, he's not getting anywhere near in the budget process the whole range of spending that you and he wanted. So when the legislative leaders call you and him later today and say, tell us what matters most, what's at the top of your priority list, because you're not getting it all, what is at the top of the priority list?
So my message all along to the legislators has been, look, all five core components of our strategy are important, and I hope you can invest across all five of those.
But they're not going to do that. They're not. Even if it's a brilliant idea, today's message was we're not going to do
it. I'm still hopeful that the good people will do the right thing, and they're going to hear very strongly from myself and other advocates on this issue. All five pieces are important. We need to invest in all five. The dollar figure, that's up to them to figure out, but all five are important.
Let's squeeze one more quick call, and if we can, Gary and Peabody, you're on with Secretary Malone, new Secretary of Education, 3 months, 2 months, whatever it is.
10 weeks.
10 weeks, thank you. Who's counting? Gary, go ahead.
Thank you. Secretary Malone, I have two suggestions here. One thing that I've observed over four decades, I'm in Peabody at the moment, but I live in the town of Webster, and I have seen over a span of four decades, school committee members getting elected both for the purpose of putting in a relative or friend into a position of authority, and then these people act as if they are untouchable royalty. And I don't know if there's anything the legislature could enact to prevent the school committee from putting in relatives and friends blatantly, you know, into positions for which they are unqualified.
We're up against time,
Gary. Thank you for that piece anyway.
Thanks, Gary. Go ahead.
The Ed Reform Act of 1993 did a lot to prevent that. And school committees, of course, they're unwieldy at times and things can be difficult. But, I would suggest, you continue to advocate locally around best practices. I think in places that are high functioning and working well, school committees are an integral part of the process. In places where it's less so, the kids aren't doing well. So thank you.
Hey, Secretary Malone, how long did you teach at the Jeremiah Burke High School?
4 years.
4 years. That's a tough school.
I was the history teacher in 4 years at Burke High School. I taught U.S. history, world history, and if you can believe, African-American history at Burke High School. And for the best years of my life, it was the first state turnaround initiative, and we were successful. And I'd never seen a place rally around a group of kids as strongly as that 4 years of my life. So I learned a lot. It formed me as professionally as to who I am today, that experience.
Secretary Malone, before you go, I never give advice to elected officials. I'm going to give it to you anyway. When you go to the legislature and try to convince them to turn on this, here's what I think you should say to every one of them, because I've spent time at the State House. You should say, trash is our enemy. Homework is our friend. Is that something? Can you integrate that into your rap, Secretary Malone?
I'm going to try, and I'm doing my best with everyone. And I just have to say to you, we've had more fun meeting these elected officials both at the State House and in their district and engaging them face-to-face, and we're getting a lot of goodwill and positivity, but the next step is the money. We need their help in this investment because this is all about kids. It's not about me. It's not about the governor. It's not about them. It's about the kids.
How passionate is he on this subject?
I'd say a 10 out of 10.
Yeah, I'd say a 10 out of 10. It's been great talking to you, and good luck. I'm glad you're the new commissioner of education.
I'm just happy you guys are back on the radio.
Happier than we are.
Because I had a job for you, but I figured we're not related. I could do that. But if you think about at some point, I'd like to be able to come back. This is a 22-month job for me.
I want to come back
and talk about education.
We'd love it.
All right.
Soon. Secretary, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Secretary of Education Matt Malone, the newly installed secretary. Thank you very much for being with us today. Okay, on to another outrage. If you're outraged about schools and you're not happy with the schools, wait to hear about this. You think hailing a cab in Boston is hard? Well, things are really hard for the cab drivers. Corruption is rampant. We're going to talk about that next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
To everyone who supports Boston Public Radio,
thank you.
Because thanks to you, listeners across New England can stay connected to quality journalism,
inspiring programs,
and thought-provoking stories
from across New England
and around the world.
For more ways to support your community through Boston Public Radio, visit wgbhnews.org/volunteer.
This program is made possible thanks to you and White Oak Cottages at Fox Hill Village in Westwood, providing assisted living care for those with Alzheimer's and dementia in a family home environment with 12 private bedrooms. WhiteOakCottages.com. And Davis Maugham and DeAugustine, PC, attorneys at law, knowing the lay of the land, not just the law. On the web at DavisMaugham.com. DavisMaugham.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Today is day three of this spotlight series in the Boston Globe on the taxi cab industry in Boston. We've learned of drivers having to pay bribes to get a shift, grossly inadequate liability insurance that would scare a rider if he or she knew, medallion owners operating above the law and getting very wealthy doing it. Yesterday, the mayor responded. Joining us is a member of that Globe spotlight team, the reporter who went undercover as a cab driver. Welcome, Bob Holler.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Thank you so much for being here. I got to tell you, I have been in a frenzy reading this series. I mean, you know, today you had a guy that's on kidney dialysis. These cab drivers are working 12-hour days, 7 days a week, getting ripped off left and right. They've been complaining. We read this morning how a union organizer, and good for her, has gone to the city council and the mayor saying this is disgraceful. It's been going on for years. who's to blame here? Is it Mayor Menino's fault? Is it the legislature's fault for not acting sooner on this? I mean, this is just outrageous.
Well, we really are. It's a world-class city, and we really are treating these guys, thousands of workers and residents of the city, as if they're in third-world countries. And
totally.
It really is disgraceful. And, you know, the city created this system, and the city is responsible for regulating it, and yet they've just all this is happening right under their noses, and they have pretty much turned a blind eye to it, to mix my metaphors, but they all have some role in it. The legislature, the city, the mayor, the police commissioner, and finally they've stepped up. I mean, the mayor says he doesn't participate in sort of the day to day doings of the police department. He says he didn't really know about all these little intricacies of what was going on in the Hackney division, but they need help.
Yet you had the state police apparently knew something, because the state police went in and arrested five people at Logan Airport while the Boston police are doing nothing. Tell us about it.
Well, that's a great irony. I mean, what is that? I mean, why can the state police, the Hackney police in Boston get these same sorts of tips from people? They could have acted. The Hackney police go out regularly and conduct these stings on drivers who don't pick up, the handicapped, or drivers who don't take fares to East Boston, who don't pick up people of all races, and that's legitimate stuff. That's good stuff. But why not go into the garages and see how the owners are ripping off these? Do a sting in the garage and see how these owners are ripping off the drivers, and they don't do it.
It sounds to me like they didn't want to do it, and that's what I'm getting at. Is there some sort of bribery? I guess you can't answer this question, but it looks to me, because I'll say it, it looks to me like there's some payoffs going on here. There must be some money changing hands, which made certain politicians unwilling to look at this cab industry. Am I crazy for jumping to that conclusion?
No. I mean, we heard allegations that that's happened throughout the years, and it's, we thought that it's cleaned up a little bit. We don't have proof that money changed hands, but there certainly is a cozy relationship between the fleet owners and the regulators, and the system is really rigged to begin with, in the fleet owner's favor.
But now, after 3 days of the series, they are shocked, as in Casablanca,
shocked
that bribery and, there's so many parts of this. We're discussing and talking to Bob Hohler, who is one of the spotlight team members of the Globe that did this series. He went undercover as a cab driver. We're going to talk about that experience in a minute. But if you're a Boston cab driver and you're listening, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. Or if you're a rider, and when you hear, as we learned in this series, that the liability insurance that's carried by Boston Cab, which has a fifth of the medallions in the city, is $20,000. $20,000. Right. How much is it on one of those black livery vehicles out at Logan, Bob?
Well, Massport requires that they buy $1 million insurance.
A million.
And
it's $20,000 of liability insurance on one of the Boston cabs you get into.
The bike messengers. How much do bike messengers have?
$50,000.
$50,000. So the bike messengers are paying $50,000. The cab drivers are paying $20,000. You were in an accident yourself, Bob Hohler, when you were driving a car. I mean, what happens to people that are run over by cabs or severely injured in cabs?
Especially for people who've gotten in accidents in Boston cabs, there's been a long history of real problems of the cab company really putting these people off for years, making it as difficult as possible to collect any money from them. It's been well documented in our series and before that, and judges have come down hard on them. And it's really sort of this wild, wild west atmosphere out there, and riders don't, passengers don't, aren't aware of it.
And then there's the other side of this. Tell us about the gentleman who owns Boston Cab and his the wealth he's managed to accumulate while these drivers, I'm going to give these guys huge tips from now on. I'm never going to complain about a cab driver for as long as, or I'm never going to call a Boston Cab either, that's for sure. But tell us about the guy that runs Boston Cab.
Well, in many ways, he really is, the epitome of the American dream. I mean, he's a guy who came over here and as a teenager.
He is?
Yeah, he is. I mean, but the beginning of it, the beginning of the story, he comes up from nothing. He was a cab driver, and he built this huge empire, and he tells people, I was a cab driver once. I know how these people are. But he's proven in his day-to-day business that he's forgotten what it's like to be a cab driver, by the way he allows his underlings in particular to treat these people. I had a caller yesterday say, he may be a nice guy, but some of his lieutenants are like the sons of Saddam Hussein.
Well, he also has massive real estate holdings. He has a vineyard down in Chile somewhere. He's made millions and millions of dollars. And yet, as you document, when these drivers come in at the end of the day, there's no receipts exchanged or records. This seems like it's a cash operation, which is rife for, again, exploitation and underpayment of taxes.
Well, we know the federal government is conducting a criminal investigation on this, and so we're going to see where this leads us. But the fact that this guy is so rich and continues to squeeze nickels and pennies out of these poor drivers is just is outrageous. Especially knowing where he came from.
So 877-301-8970. If you're a Boston cab driver, we'd love to hear from you. If you're a rider, we'd like your reaction. So you go undercover. You drive, what, for 8 days? Is that what you...
8 nights, yeah.
Tell us what life is like. What do they make? What do they have to do to get a shift? What is life like for the cab drivers we all like to complain about? What's life like for these people?
Well, it wasn't even probably 15 minutes of my first shift, my first night in the garage waiting for a cab. When a driver told me, "Hey man, you know, if you want to get a cab, you're gonna have to pay these guys, this dispatcher at the window. This is like a third world country. This is how they do business. You've got to do that," which I collected in my memory. But I didn't bribe the dispatchers. I waited. I had to wait more than 2 hours to get my cab.
2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what were you supposed to pay him if you wanted to get the cab in 10 minutes?
Well, it wasn't clear,
$20, $30?
You know, I saw them being handed $2, $5. They told me don't even bother trying to drive on Friday and Saturday nights at Boston Cab in my orientation session, because those are the nights when it's really competitive. And those are the nights when they really collect some money. They get the $10, the $20, we're told, by numerous. Dozens of drivers told us.
And, individual amounts of money don't seem like that much, but you make a point. Whoever wrote today's story, it was today's story, talk about how even if you fill the gas tank, as you're supposed to on the way back, they say, well, you owe us, what was it, $2.59. And you say to yourself, at least, what's $2.59? And then you, whoever wrote it, said, if you extrapolate that across the whole number of men and women who are driving for this company, it could be $100,000 a year just from that alone that they're extorting from their drivers.
It's incredible. And this year alone, from the beginning of this year until now, Boston Cab has overcharged the drivers who lease their cabs more than $100,000, more than $2,000 a piece for these 2009 vehicles, which they were told, the police department told them at the first of the year, you cannot charge this surcharge, this new car premium surcharge to these drivers. And they've continued to do it, regardless of the regulators telling them they can't. It's outrageous.
You know, I want to get to the calls at 877-301-8970, but I want to just pick up on what Marjorie said a minute ago, and I know you're not an editorialist, so it's hard to deal with this. When you read this whole series, and if you guys have not, you got to go to bostonglobe.com and read.
You'll have a nervous breakdown.
There are only two possible conclusions one reach, that the people who are in charge are so clueless that it is frightening, or what's equally frightening is they're not clueless at all. They just decided we're going to let this pass for whatever reason it is. There's no conclusion one can reach about leadership that is not incredibly depressing. I know you can't respond to that. Let's go to Andy in Boston. You're on with Bob Holler, one of the Spotlight team members that wrote this incredible series about cabs, Boston cabs, in the Boston Globe. Hey, Andy.
Hey, how you doing? Yes, I used to drive a cab in Boston, and I leased a cab. I was paying $150 for 12 hours on the flat rate, okay? So what would happen was when I came to radio in for a call, they'd give me like a $3 ride, $5 ride, and I'd barely cover my shift with it, you know? So they give you enough meter time, I mean, enough radio time to, you know, give you, you know, to make up for your lease. The Teamsters had a deal with them where they split the meter 50-50. So they're looking at a $150 ride to Rhode Island. It went to the Teamsters. And if they're looking for someone coming back from the Stop and Shop with a $3 fare, went to a lease guy. So
yeah, it's really been systemic. I mean, exploitation and extortion and bribery throughout the system for years. And that's another issue is that drivers, in many cases, will get better fares if they bribe the radio or computer dispatcher. It's not just the window dispatcher who gives them the keys. It's the person who's dispatching the calls as well.
Well, I'm saying that they're dispatching. You've got a lease. You're paying $150 for 12 hours.
$150 for one day?
You said 12 hours.
Oh, my God.
12 hours.
Which is one of the reasons.
You get $150, then you got $30, $40 in gas a day. Right.
Yeah.
You're getting $3 rides on the radio because they've already got the money off you. You've already paid your lease for the 12 hours.
Andy, did you go home some days with no money in your pocket?
I went home owing on it. I'd owe like $30, $40 sometimes. Oh, that's under 12 hours work. Yeah, and it seems that they get 50-50 on the meter. So the $150 ride, Rhode Island, wherever, that goes to Teamsters because they get $75 to the cab company, $75 goes to the driver, right? But with the lease, you pay the lease up front for the day. So you're paying.
We got it. Andy, thanks for the call.
That brings up a great issue here. He said there's some drivers that are unionized for the Teamsters. There, I thought stupidly that the Taxi Drivers Association was a union, but I was wrong.
Right. No, there is no official union in Boston right now of taxis. When I drove back in the 70s, there was a union. There was a Teamsters union. That's been long gone since the 70s. And we did have union protections. And we had, not only that, we were employees of the company. We got paid vacations. We got weekly wages. We got subsidized health insurance. We got pensions. We got workman's comp.
Wow.
We have sick leave. All these things that these drivers have no access to at all.
And the reason there's no union, I would imagine, is very hard to organize. A lot of people that have just arrived in the United States of America and they're scrounging to make a living.
There's also a question as to whether or not they're even unionizable because they're not treated as employees. They're treated as independent contractors. So the owners of these fleets don't have to pay benefits. They don't. So they get it coming and going. Let's talk about the rider for a second, though. So we found that you get in the Boston Cab Company. Liability insurance is $20,000. That puts you in a pretty bad shape. You describe something called iron shifts. What's that? We're driving 24 hours?
24 hours.
Is anybody talking? I mean, I am not crazy about getting into a cab where a man or a woman has been driving for 16, 17, 18, 20 hours and is probably aggravated about the fact that they had to pay a bribe to get the cab to begin with. Does anybody care about that?
Oh, it's frightening. It really is frightening. I mean, we talk to drivers who say, hey, you know, I'd fall asleep at the red light and, you know, the passenger would have to wake me up. Drivers said, I'd continually, you know, veer off the road, not continually, but at times veer off the road and just wake up just in time not to hit the guardrail.
And they're all asleep out in Logan Airport, I guess, waiting for their first fares in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, is this just, you looked at Boston Cab. Do we, for those of us who are thinking, I can never take a Boston cab again until this massive reform, are there other cab companies that are better that we should patronize? Or what does the occasional cab rider do?
Well, in terms of the drivers trying to make a living, and in terms of the drivers, you see a lot of cranky and grumpy drivers out there. And I think that's throughout the city because of the system that's in place. It's so hard for them to make money just without the corruption. Just as it's set up regulatory-wise, it's so hard for them to make money. They're going to be grumpy and cranky. We do hear, for instance, Metro Cab seems to have a good reputation, although they don't really own medallions. They seem to have a good operation from what we're told by drivers in terms of the way they do their business.
So we should call Metro Cab then.
That seems to be one.
Just a couple of quick questions about the whole medallion thing. You guys write about a guy who, of course, we never heard of, the guy who has been running the Hackney licensing division of the police department for 30-plus years. His name is Mark Cohen. For starters, I know the answer, but a lot of people don't. How many medallions, there are 1,825, how many have been suspended by Mark Cohen in his three decades as the head of the Hackney division?
Well, he's never revoked a medallion. In his words, he's never revoked a medallion in those 30 years.
Despite the fact, as you told me last night and as I read, give us an example or two of what some people have done that have caused Mark Cohen to determine that they shouldn't lose their medallion. Give us a couple of examples.
One fellow was he has a son who's a state trooper and another son who works for Massport, and between them they own 11 medallions. He was a longtime official at Independent Taxi Owners Association, ITOA, and it was discovered by the other board members that he allegedly stole at least $200,000 embezzled from the company over a course of years, and actually during a period when he was a big supporter of the mayor and held a fundraiser for fleet owners at his house, which the mayor attended. And so when he was found to have embezzled that money, he was sued in court. They didn't press for criminal charges for some reason, but he ended up settling that for $40,000. He never lost his medallions. He still owns two. His sons own the others. A couple other guys went to prison for bribing Hackney officials to get licenses for immigrants, Russian immigrants who were not qualified to get their
licenses. They lose their medallion for that?
They didn't lose them. They transferred them to their family members. One transferred them all to his wife. And so he's still allegedly involved in the business.
Can we stay on medallions just for one second?
We have a good email from a taxi driver, Zach, who says, most of the Hackney officers are medallion owners themselves. I think the big problem is the value of these medallions. They should not be a half million dollars.
Well, we didn't find any Hackney officer owns a medallion. I don't believe that's true. But the value of the medallions is incredible. It's more than 600,000 right now, up from, you know, 325, 6-7 years ago. It's doubled. And, you know, we're on pace for $1 million per medallion.
Well, that's the thing. The last thing I want to ask you about. There's 6,200 drivers, 1,825 medallions. So right away, they're building in this incredible competition. That's point one. Point two, you can't get a cab if you're a rider. So it seems to me the fact that the city is not saying, let's go add 300 medallions or 500 medallions, which obviously would cause the value to go down because there'd be a larger supply. The only people who benefit from the failure to allow more medallions are the owners of the fleets. Is that not obvious?
Yeah, and it's incredible. They did add 300 medallions over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, and yet they regulate the system so that the owners are guaranteed to make their money. They raise the rates. They may have to add more medallions in the coming years. But I guarantee you that the owners, it will continue to be a profitable business for the
Jim,
owners.
Jim, the medallion owners are not the only ones that are profiting from this.
Who's that?
It is the politicians that I would guess are getting significant campaign contributions from those medallion owners. There's a reason why this has not been straightened out. There's a reason why the mayor hasn't looked harder at it. This Mark Cohen fellow that kept telling you, the guy that is the leader of the Hackney division since the 1980s, keeps saying, bring me a victim. There's a reason why the legislature hasn't acted. There's a reason why the city council hasn't acted. And I am somewhat suspicious about what those reasons might be.
Well, you have a huge voiceless, powerless constituency there in these thousands of drivers. And we all know that more than 90% of them are immigrants, you know, mostly new immigrants. They have nobody advocating for them. They do have a new union that's trying to get organized and do that.
Good.
But without those kind of people, who's going to respond to them? The politicians don't respond to somebody who doesn't have any power or voice.
Bob, before you leave, Bob Holler from the Boston Globe. Tell us, Mark Cohen, who we talked about a little bit, and there can't be enough publicity from our perspective of Mark Cohen's exploits. When he was asked, I think the question by one of you was, you know, what are your qualifications? What in your history suggests that you'd be good at this? What's his flip response?
Well, I think you're referring to a question where they said, you know, what did you do earlier in your life? And he said, well, I was a kindergarten teacher at one point, which is perfect training for dealing with these guys, which is a kind of arrogant.
What a jerk.
Arrogant.
You know, I do have one last question because I know we're up against the clock here, but I'm not even going to try to pronounce the gentleman's name who runs Boston Cab Company.
Titanjan.
Thank you. Is it possible that there will be criminal charges brought against him based on the reporting you've done at this point?
Well, I mean, the fact that the feds are investigating, I guess, makes it a possibility. I mean, that he or someone in his building, it certainly makes it a possibility.
And can you keep on this, following up on what the politicians do about this? I mean, this is just, you're absolutely right. These are people that came from Haiti, from Africa, from who knows where, scrounging out a living, and they're getting treated like they're, you're right, in a third world country. This is one of the most disgraceful things I've read.
Panhandlers on wheels is how they're described in one of the Globe. It wasn't my line. It was one of the lines in the story.
Somebody's got to do something about this.
Well, the Spotlight team doesn't rest, so we'll stay on it.
Good.
So, Bob, if I need to catch a cab from Cambridge to GBH, I can call you tomorrow morning, and you're not driving anymore.
I won't be there for you, Jim.
Bob Holler, you have done spectacular work. Your colleagues have done spectacular work. And if any of you out there have not read this series, again, Google
it
on bostonglobe.com. Bob, thanks so
Thank
much
you
for
so
coming
much,
in.
Jim and Marjorie. Thank you.
Okay, my blood pressure has to go back down now. We're going to be talking with Charlie Baker up next on Open Mic. He's with us every Tuesday. Stay with us as well. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We're trying to untangle the social safety net, where the term came from and what it means to different people.
All those with true need can rest assured that the social safety net of programs they depend on are exempt from any cuts.
I'm Sarah Gardner. A brief safety net history next on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Safety Insurance, committed to safe driving. Safety Insurance would like to remind Massachusetts drivers that it is now illegal to text and drive. You can learn more at safetyinsurance.com. Be safe. Don't text and drive.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is a frenzied, up-in-arms Marjorie Egan. Joining us on the phone is the former head of Harvard Pilgrim. He's the former Republican candidate for governor in 2010, and he's with us every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. Good afternoon, Charlie Baker.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Excellent.
Hi, Charlie.
I'm kind of glad that I'm not there so that Marjorie has all the room she needs.
You don't know.
You've seen this story about the taxi industry in Boston. It's just so enraging. But we've talked enough about that. Charlie Baker, I want to ask you about something else which may or may not be enraging to you. I'm not sure. Deval Patrick asked for nearly $2 billion in new taxes, the money to go to transportation, you know, more train lines, better rail service, better roads, bridges, et cetera, and a lot of it to go to education. Specifically to early childhood education. This morning we learned that he's going to get not nearly what he hoped for, only about $500 million, most of that go to transportation. What do you think?
I think that's a statement about the difference between, you know, sort of somebody who isn't running for office again and a whole bunch of people who are. I mean, the folks in the legislature obviously are taking what I would describe as a, you know, sort of incremental approach to this, and one that I think in some respects is perfectly defensible. I mean, if you just look at the 2008 reform legislation that was passed, where the state was going to do a whole bunch of things with regard to improving the way it did business in the transportation space before sort of coming back beyond the sales tax increase to ask people for more money, you know, there are probably maybe 10 recommendations. I think they've done two. There's a lot of stuff out there on the reform side that, frankly, ought to be done and ought to be done first. Before you start looking for $2 billion in a pretty crummy economy in a state that isn't all that economically competitive.
But, Charlie Baker, when you were running for governor, you were talking a lot, and you have since and before talked a lot about jobs. By opting for this smaller amount, this $500 million, what the legislature is not willing to finance is the expansion of commuter rail service to the South Coast, extending the Green Line, expanding South Station. For a guy who's worried about the environment in which we try to attract companies or get companies to expand here, isn't that bad news on the economic front?
But, Jim, you can't talk about raising your income tax. Remember, most small businesses in Massachusetts, the businesses that actually create new jobs, most of those businesses are organized in Massachusetts as either S corporations or limited liability corporations. And for your listeners, what that means is that they get taxed at whatever the personal income rate is. And, you know, raising that rate by a full point, which is like a 20-25% increase, when you're trying to encourage more of these folks to grow and expand in Massachusetts, it's just really bad policy. And the other thing I would say, and I come back to this and everybody always ignores it, if you have an agenda that you put out there that required you to do a whole bunch of things to fix and improve the way you do business, and the simplest one is simply getting out of the business of, you know, expanding your rail system without actually figuring out how you're going to pay for the price of operating that expanded rail system, which we still haven't done in Massachusetts, then what you're really, the real outcome of all this, if we actually just did it the way the governor's talking about it, is the T would actually be in deeper deficit than it is now. Because every time you expand it using the current way they do business, all you really do is dig a deeper hole on the operating side.
So what would you do, Charlie Baker? I mean, when you drive around parts of the state, as you have a million times, you go to some of the tougher cities. You go to Lawrence, you go to Lowell, you go to my hometown of Fall River. We're just talking about third world countries, that the cab driver conditions in Boston. Some of those cities are starting to look like the third world. I mean, it's really unbelievable. How do you go about fixing? The bridges are falling apart.
Wait a second. Forget
okay,
these.
So
drive under a bridge on Starro Drive in Boston. You don't have to go to Lawrence. You don't have to go to Holyoke. But go ahead. I'm sorry, Charlie.
Okay. So let's talk about the gateway cities, which is what Marjorie's talking about, right? I would much rather make big investments in those cities themselves rather than think that if you simply build a line and don't deal with the public safety issues, don't deal with the brownfield issues, don't deal with the education issues, don't deal with the labor force issues, and somehow you're actually going to create opportunity there. I mean, my view on this is I said this back in 2010. My goal would be to make big investments in those communities themselves. And the big investments have got to be in cleaning up their industrial sites, getting really aggressive aggressive about improving the quality of their schools, dealing with some of their public safety issues, and creating, you know, practically enterprise-free zones for employers to start investing in those places. If you don't do that sort of thing, I'm sorry, you're not going to get the solution you're looking for. Let me just give you a good example of this. Newburyport, up on the North Shore.
Yep.
The mayor up there in the 70s, maybe the 80s, was a guy named Byron Matthews, a Republican. He applied for and got a whole bunch of CDAG and UDAG money back when the federal government used to put that money out, and he completely rebuilt the waterfront in Newburyport. And it was the single biggest and most important thing that ever happened. Now, eventually, 95 got up there, okay?
Yeah.
But the thing that really changed the place more than anything else was the big investment in their center city. And if we don't, and there's, they had a huge improvement in the quality of their schools. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that's a lot more local that you got to chase here if you really want to improve the opportunity and the quality of life in those places.
But Charlie, unless I misunderstood you, the Newburyport example was a function of federal grants. Is that right?
Correct.
So that's federal grants. You want to do the brownfield and whatever. Where does the money come from? Very few people I've heard disagree with the bulk of what the governor wants to do on transportation, some exceptions, and early education, K through 12, et cetera. It always comes down to the money. But you just described this great outcome in Newburyport. Without federal tax dollars, it wouldn't happen.
No, but my point here, Jim, okay, so Jim, there's a difference between money spent on one thing and money spent on something else. It wasn't about building a rail line that turned around what was going on in Newburyport. It was about making investment in the center city of the community and making other investments locally. I really think the mistake with the governor's proposal is you're talking about this assumption that if you build a rail line, that's going to solve all those other problems. I just don't think that's for real. And as far as the early ed investment is concerned, I think there are certainly things you could probably do in early ed, although I would argue that the data suggests you should experiment with a bunch of different models before you just, you know, really roll in with a huge hundreds of millions of dollars investment. And the other thing you got to worry about there is if the K-12 systems aren't up to snuff, then whatever you might get out of the early ed investment is just going to wander away over the course of the next 3 or 4 years. I mean, you can't.
Go ahead,
Charlie. You can't solve everything at once, but the notion that you should chase these things incrementally, I think, is the right way to go. And for me, in the education piece in particular, especially in cities, it still needs to be all about the K-12 system. If you don't fix the K-12 system, then putting money into an early ed system that prepares kids for kindergarten and first grade, that's all going to wash out by the time they're in the third or fourth grade.
Yeah, but the flip side of that, Charlie Baker, is even if you have a brilliant K-12, if the kid is not ready as compared to another kid from another school or another home who has more advantages, if that kid's not ready for K-12 or K-1, et cetera, then he or she is going to finish in the backseat anyway.
A lot of the kids who end up in some of our highest performing middle schools in some of our cities, many of which are charter schools, but some of which are not, show up pretty far behind the eight ball. And by the time they leave that middle school to go to high school, they've completely caught up. I mean, I think people are thinking the wrong way. And by the way, Jim, if you want to try some experiments, like one of the things I thought we should try, and there's plenty of room to maneuver this and to do this, but it doesn't cost $500 million, is why don't we start for kids who are going to be going into kindergarten in September, why don't we start a preschool for them in April of the previous year?
That's
and
not a bad idea.
Give them a head start on September.
Yeah. Hey, I want you to know, Charlie, Marjorie's endorsed that. Charlie, before we leave this topic, just so I'm clear, at least what the legislature did today, a dramatic cutback on the transportation funding, no new projects, essentially maintain and repair is what they voted for today, $500 million, gas tax, cigarette tax, and something on computers. Do you support that?
You know, conceptually, yes, although I have to tell you guys, I don't actually know what the legislature did today. I haven't read it. So,
well, they did raise $500 million in taxes, but you're not saying you would rule out supporting that $500 million depending on what exactly they're taxing, correct?
Yeah, although I really do think, and I've said this to you before, Jim, and it just isn't that exciting to you, if you don't fix a bunch of things about the way you currently run your business and operate your business, then to some extent you're not going to solve your problem in the long run, period. And that always gets lost in this conversation.
Charlie Baker, I want to ask you another question, changing the topic here, about judges elected or appointed. And the reason I'm asking it is there's a story in both the Herald and the Globe today about this, well, it's been for several days now, about this guy, Gary Irving, convicted of rape 34 years ago.
Three rapes.
Right. He raped three young women over the course, teenage girls in a couple of cases, over the course of a summer, and he was let go. Let's hear from State Police Detective Lieutenant Michael Farley.
On the trip on the way back, he was asked if when he stopped looking over his shoulder, and he said he never did. You read what he did to these girls, and I just couldn't imagine it. So that would get us back going again.
Good for the State Police, my heroes. But in any case, the judge in this case, very oddly, after a conviction of three rapes, let the 18-year-old defendant go home to get his affairs in order before sentencing. And this Gary Irving, who's now 52, took off, hasn't been heard from since. So the judge is no longer with us. He's deceased. But I wonder, you know, what do you think about some remedy for judges? Should they be elected? Should they be reassessed after 5 years, 10 years? There was no way to do anything to this judge under the system as it is today.
Well, you can recall judges, can't you?
I don't know if there's a recall in Massachusetts. I'm not sure.
Didn't we pursue a recall with Judge Lopez after that case? I think there was a legislative effort that was mounted. She eventually resigned, I think. But
yeah.
I think there was an attempt to pursue the recall mechanism. I think the idea of a 10-year review is probably a good one. I know that a lot of folks in the bar think that's, you know, unwieldy and hard to manage, but let's face it, you know, lifetime appointment, if you make a mistake, that's a heck of a lot of opportunity when you put the wrong person in one of those jobs to really screw up a lot of people's lives. So I think the idea of having some sort of a check and balance on that's perfectly appropriate.
I'm with you. And by the way, I think it's something like Mitt Romney suggested when he was governor, too. Charlie, a couple of quick things before we let you go. Scott Brown was with us the other day. We asked him what he thought of the United States Senate debates, the Republican and Democratic debates. He said he had not watched them. He was out with his wife in the North End for dinner. Did you watch the debates?
I did.
And give us your quick sense of the Republican field.
I think the same thing I've thought all along, which is that name ID is going to be hugely important in this, and that does give Mike Sullivan a certain advantage because of the public positions he's held in the past. I think Gabriel Gomez has raised a bunch of money, which I'm assuming he'll start spending on TV and radio, which will help him with name ID. And Dan's got to figure out a way to compete in the name ID business, and Lord knows he's got plenty of issues and ideas and all the rest, but he's got to figure out a way to sort of elbow his way into that conversation.
Okay, so unlike Scott Brown, you watched the debate. Next question is, did you watch Scott Brown last night sitting in for Bill O'Reilly?
No, I did not, actually.
Well, here it is, just because you missed it, here's a little excerpt of former Senator Brown sitting in on the O'Reilly factor last night.
I speak with many of my former staff and colleagues on a regular basis and remain plugged in. So what if I told you that the leaders in both the House and the Senate, along with the Vice President, are actually close to solving our country's most vexing financial problems? If you're saying to yourself, wow, that seems too good to be true, you'd be right. It's April Fool's Day, and the April Fool's joke is, guess what? It's on all of us.
Okay, review the performance, please, Charlie Baker, of your fellow Republican. That would be former Senator Scott Brown. Go ahead.
I think that's pretty good. I like that.
Well, we knew you'd say that.
You guys know I'm a psycho about the federal deficit. So
yeah,
anytime somebody talks about the federal deficit, they certainly get my attention.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the federal deficit, the last question for me, when Dan Winslow turned to Michael Sullivan and said, I know you care about the deficit, you've given us one way, you're going to reduce it by waste, what's your second way? And his response was he was going to reduce spending. What do you think of that as an answer, Charlie Baker?
You know something? I really, the 30-minute format for three people to debate a whole bunch. I mean, I would much rather see longer debates and focused on specific topics, because I think it's enormously difficult for the viewers and, frankly, for the participants and even for the journalists who are involved in the Q&A part to get what they would like to get out of those things in that kind of a format.
Okay, Charlie,
don't you think so?
But the problem is, I think nobody watches
even the
short ones.
You get more information out of me in the course of one of these conversations.
That's one man's opinion.
Yeah. Well, if you ever run again, Charlie, we hope you do. We'll push for the Lincoln-Douglas format. You know,
one hour on one side,
absolutely. 1 hour on the other side, yep. And three people will watch. But other than that.
And we will be quite capable of putting everyone into a coma.
Hey, Charlie, even though every week I ask you if a Republican can be elected president in 2016 without supporting gay marriage, we're going to take a break for 1 week. You'll get to contemplate it for one more week. We'll ask you next Tuesday.
That's big of you, Jim.
Thank you very much.
That.
Hey, Charlie Baker, it's a pleasure. We'll talk to you next Tuesday.
See you guys.
See you.
And tomorrow, 1 o'clock for Open Mic is the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy. But coming up, where can kids eat for free? Where does beer flow for only $5 for a 12-ounce serving? The airlines don't even offer deals like this. We're talking about Fenway Park. What they have in store for this month is next on Boston Public Radio.
Did you know the first license to brew beer in America was given to a man in Charlestown in 1637? It's true. And you can satisfy your thirst for knowledge at the Taste of WGBH History of Beer event, Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. at WGBH's studios in Brighton. And don't worry, your taste buds won't be neglected. You'll get to sample a bunch of Samuel Adams' finest historic brews while you're there. For tickets and more information, go to wgbh.org/events.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Mass Eye and Ear, offering specialty services at more than a dozen locations in the Boston area, and now a new center in the Longwood Medical Area. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And Butler Hospital, conducting a research study for depression requiring daily visits for 6 weeks involving a new form of brain stimulation. Information at 401-455-6537 or newdepressionstudy.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She, of course, is Marjorie Egan. Joining us, I believe, to announce that Washington Nationals Red Sox World Series tickets are on sale tomorrow at 10 is the Chief Operating Officer of the Boston Red Sox, Sam Kennedy. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Great to be with you guys. What a difference a day makes.
It is unbelievable. Yes, Sam.
So, Sam, for people that don't know, what exactly are you doing at Fenway and why are you doing it?
Well, we're going to have a lot of winning competitive baseball all season long.
Well, besides that, food-wise.
In April, we've rolled out kind of a special welcome back promotion for fans where we're going to have free food for kids, free kids' meals all April for the 17 games that we have, 2-for-1 hot dogs, and we're bringing back a $5 12-ounce draft beer, which we haven't had at Fenway since 2004, which was a mildly exciting season for us, so we thought maybe we'd bring back some good luck with that, and seems to have gotten a lot of attention, this announcement, but really is just meant to be a small gesture of thanks. Our real focus is on putting a competitive team on the field year in and year out. That's what we're focused on.
Now, Sam Kennedy, I have to be transparent here and say I would go anywhere for 2 hot dogs for the price of 1, but when I first read this thing in the Globe or the Herald or ESPN, Boston, wherever it was, I said to myself, well, it's not the biggest thing in the world, but it's, as you say, a small gesture, obviously been a crummy season in a month, and they're trying to say, listen, thanks for coming. You're trying to fill seats. Are you surprised by the hostility of some fans to this proposal? You've heard the hostility. Are you surprised by that or no?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the short answer is no. I mean, listen, we're those of us who are Bostonians by birth and have grown up here in Boston and New England know the Red Sox mean so much to so many of us and our kids and our mothers and our fathers and our grandfathers and our great-grandmothers. So any time that we fall short of expectations, there's going to be anger and residual anger. I mean, listen, it's been a difficult 18 months. We're teasing about our great victory in at Yankee Stadium yesterday, but it was an important game. I mean, it sounds crazy, but it really was. We needed to get off to a good start, and yes, it's only one game, but we haven't been in first place since September of 2011, and we have high expectations around here. So there's some residual anger and disappointment over the way the team's been playing, and you know, it's incumbent upon us to recognize that and do everything we can to get better, not just on the field, but off the field. We owe that to our fans, and that's what John Henry and Tom Werner and Larry Lucchino have been committed to. And we know when we fall short, we need to take the criticism and do our best to live up to those high expectations that we have. So that's what we need to do.
Yeah, that's the chief operating officer of the Boston Red Sox, Sam Kennedy. If you want to talk to him, you can call him at 877-301-8970. And you mentioned a couple of seconds ago, Sam, you know, for people who were born here, at 12 o'clock today, we spoke to a Dorchester kid who was born and raised here. He's probably the biggest Red Sox fan on the planet. We asked him what his reaction was to the cheaper beer and all that sort of thing. Here's what John King from CNN had to say.
The cheaper beer thing is a brilliant idea.
And he went on to say, let the kids fend for themselves. So at least you have John King on your side. You know, Sam, I've lived my whole life in Philly, New York, and Boston. I would argue the most intense sports cities in the world. But I have to say, I have never experienced anything in New York or Philadelphia like what exists here in Boston, where people live and die. As you say, jokingly, yesterday, obviously you win, you're going to the World Series, and if you lose tomorrow's game, which hopefully you will not, it's sort of like death and destruction. How do you deal with this as a business guy and with your colleagues in the Red Sox? How do you deal with that ebb and flow thing?
Yeah, well, you try to just remember that what makes baseball so great is the dailiness of the game and the storylines that unfold over a long season. And I'd love to tell you that we don't get too high or too low, but it's just not true. We do. We get really high when things are going well, and we reach down to the lower depths when they aren't going well. I mean, Tom Werner, our chairman, who watches every minute of every game, called me. I was in New York, and he was elsewhere. But he called me when Andrew Miller walked those first two guys. He says, "Can you believe this?" You know, I said, "Tom, we still have a 3-run lead. Hang in there. You know, it's going to be okay. It's the first game of the year." But we really do get caught up in it, and it's what makes the Red Sox so special. And no disrespect to Philly or New York. I've lived in New York City and worked in baseball in New York City. The Red Sox mean more to New Englanders and to Bostonians, in my humble opinion, than those other teams mean to their cities and to their fans. Maybe because they were a smaller city, you know, maybe because there's so much more going on in New York and Philadelphia, you know, there's a larger metropolitan area. I'm not sure what it is, but the passion for the Red Sox is unlike the passion for any other team in any other market. It's why you want to be in Boston if you're in baseball. There's nowhere better to work in baseball than Boston. It's just true.
Well, Sam Kennedy of the Red Sox, I'm one of those people that's lived here most of my life, and frankly, I'm really happy about the cheaper beer and the free food for kids. And I'm one of those people, and maybe I'd be a pink hat or one of those people that just I wouldn't come to the games so much to watch the game as come to the game for Fenway Park, because I used to love it when you could actually get tickets to Fenway Park and you could bring your kids and it didn't cost you $200 and everything wasn't like $12 for a piece of pizza and stuff like that. It's become totally unaffordable. So I can't be the only person. I don't want the Red Sox to lose. I know everybody's job depends on it. On the other hand, most of us can't go to Fenway anymore because the tickets are too expensive and the food's too expensive.
Yeah, well, it's a great point, Marjorie. And, you know, we have actually tried to do a lot to keep the low end ticket prices held flat. We've frozen prices 3 out of the last 5 years on all tickets. And I think there's a silver lining here. You know, the pace of ticket sales, it has slowed down given the collapse of 2011 and the disastrous season that was 2012. And what that silver silver lining is availability of tickets and the availability of affordable tickets. You know, we've got bleacher seats for $12. We've got bleacher seats for $28. We've got grandstand seats for $30. We've got standing room seats. And you can walk up and buy a ticket at Fenway this year. And in years past, with each and every game being sold out, that was very difficult. We did release some tickets on the day of game for sale, but this year there will be availability. So, you know, I grew up coming down on the D train to Fenway Park,
exactly,
walking up to the ticket office,
yes,
and now you can do that.
Yes.
You can do that this year. So that's probably the only good thing about having a difficult season is the availability of tickets.
Hey, Sam Kennedy, Chief Operating Officer of the Red Sox. A couple of more questions from me. I'm shocked that Marjorie hasn't mentioned this. A couple of years ago, someone was kind enough to give us playoff tickets to the Red Sox when we were on another station. We went, and Marjorie has told the story repeatedly that I'm rather large, I'm 6'5". One of the only ways I was able to get up every time the Red Sox scored a run or for the seventh inning stretch is, Marjorie jokes, I had to bring olive oil spray to get myself out of the seat.
Jim was stuck in the seat.
So I hate to argue for myself here. The seats are an issue. The size of the seats, what you guys have done is stunning. I mean, that woman Smith, I can't remember her first couple of names.
Janet Marie Smith.
Janet Marie Smith. It's staggering, and considering how old the stadium is and that kind of thing, how about the seats for people who actually are normal-sized in 2013,
normal
Sam
size.
Kennedy?
Yeah, you know, actually, the all of the seats have been either replaced, repaired, and done over throughout the renovation. The issue I think that you're referring to is probably the grandstand seats, which are the original size, the original seats that have been here for a long, long time. There were certain restrictions placed on us by the various historic agencies in terms of what we could and could not do to Fenway Park. And it was important to us to keep the original seats, especially the grandstand seats, as part of the renovation. We recognize that they are smaller. They're not as comfortable as some of the newer ballparks that are out there. And, you know, I'd say two things about that. Number one, it allows us to price them more affordably. You know, they're $50 tickets as opposed to some of the higher-end dugout seats and club seats. And number two, that's what you get when you preserve and protect an iconic ballpark. I mean, how many other baseball teams play in a 100-year-old facility? The answer is no one other than the Boston Red Sox. And, you know, Marjorie, I'm with you. Fenway Park is a huge part of the experience. I mean, you
it
remember
is.
That from
it
when
is.
You're a kid, and that's really what this ownership group came together. I mean, as long as John, Tom, and Larry own this team, which I believe will be for at least another decade, Fenway Park will always be here, and that's something that is very important. It wasn't always a certainty when they came into town, so it's important to us. But we recognize there are some drawbacks and discomforts associated with Fenway, so we need to do everything we can to make the other parts better.
You could go to the gym, you know, and maybe work.
Yeah.
But now they're offering two hot dogs for the price of one.
You know, I am curious though, Sam Kennedy, because of course, as you just mentioned, there was some question about Fenway being shut down, new stadium being elsewhere, no longer Fenway Park and Kenmore Square. What do you think? I mean, Yankee Stadium's been there now for a couple of years. How do you think the new Yankee Stadium compares with the old? I've heard great reviews of the new Yankee Stadium.
Well, I was there yesterday, and my reaction is it's very New York. It works in New York. It's big. It's over the top in many ways in terms of just how luxurious it feels. You know, it's right there still at the corner of 161st and River Avenue, and that's great that they were able to sort of replicate what they had. But you lose something. You lose kind of the soul of a sports facility anytime you build something new. And it works for them. It's a wonderful facility, but there will only be one Fenway Park, and thankfully Fenway will be here for the next generation of fans, given what John, Tom, Larry and Janet Marie Smith, as you mentioned, have achieved here over the last decade. So we're glad to be a part of that, because that's something that makes the Red Sox as important as they are in this region.
Two last quick ones from me, Sam Kennedy of the Red Sox. Number one, in addition to this first round of concession price drops, that sort of thing, is more planned? Are you guys planning on rolling out something? I know that there's a Globe editorial today talking about how you said there may be more to come. You're considering other nice gestures, for lack of a better expression, towards the fan. Is there another round on its way?
You know, there's. I don't have anything specific for you, but I will say that we would consider the possibility of extending this or another special offer if it were well received. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I'd love to clarify about the original Globe article that talked about this was that, you know, this is not the first time we've rolled out special promotions or offers. I think this one got a lot of attention given the difficult season we've had, but we make no bones about it. I mean, our first priority is to win baseball games, and no organization in the American League East has done a good a job at that as the Red Sox over the last 11 years. But our second sort of fundamental commitment is to market the team aggressively. We need to market this team. We need to sell tickets, sell sponsorships, yeah, have events here, because we need those revenues to reinvest back into baseball. So I think you will see us do more marketing, more promotions, but ultimately the first and foremost priority is spending time on the baseball operation and fixing that and getting that right. And that's what Ben Cherington and John Farrell are hoping to do this year.
Hey, Sam, last question from me is, you mentioned the word marketing a minute ago, and I mean this sincerely, not sarcastically. You guys are marketing geniuses on a whole variety of fronts. Both today in another interview I heard you do, and then in a press report on you, you've used the word disastrous to describe last season. And I mean this as a serious question. Did you guys, I mean, that's, while it's obviously accurate, considering how horrible last year was, that's quite an admission for an ownership group to say about their business, their product. Did you guys sit down and say, to basically soften or deal with the antagonism that we're facing from a lot of our fans, we have to admit the obvious before we can begin to rebuild? Was there that kind of conversation?
Yeah, there was, and I think it was a very easy conversation. I think everybody agreed. I mean, this was a disaster, and I think what's unfair, I mean, 69 wins is just unacceptable in Boston. I mean, it's unacceptable in any market, but especially Boston, where we have the resources to compete with the very best. So I don't think there was ever a doubt that we were guilty as charged for having a very difficult year. And you're going to have a bad year or two or three when you own a team for 15, 20 years. Thankfully, we haven't had too many bad years since John and Tom and Larry, yeah, took over the team. So, you know, it was something that we were, just seemed obvious that we needed to speak to it and address it. And I feel really, really good about the baseball operations plan to get back to the next great Red Sox team, which Ben Cherington keeps talking about. And, you know, John and Tom and Larry have given those guys the resources to do that. And I think as fans, we should all be excited to watch how this team gels. We've got a great mix of young players and veteran players. And we also have dry powder, if you will, to do something mid-season if there are acquisitions or trades, yeah, to be made. We have that flexibility thanks to ownership.
You know, since you're doing two hot dogs for the price of one, for people like me, maybe you should do two cans of olive oil spray for the price. Just think about that,
you know,
Sam. You don't have to give me an answer,
Sam,
now.
Sam, he's not telling you the story, right? The embarrassing truth is we had to call the Jaws of Life.
No, we did not.
Yes, we did.
Hey, Sam Kennedy.
And he had to be... the seat had to be broken. It was really humiliating for all involved.
Hey, Sam, thanks for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Great being with you guys. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, even though we've been talking about how Fenway Park is helping us save a few pennies with their cheaper beer and two-for-one hot dogs, according to John Sununu, the pennies time has come and gone. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Racial and ethnic minorities are becoming the majority in this country sooner than expected, and for many people, this rapid change will be a challenge.
There's going to be a real challenge to educate those older folks that these people are really important.
We'll talk about that next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
love our contributors. That means you. And Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting Bobby McFerrin in Spirit You All, a merging of American music styles from classic spirituals to blues and roots, at Symphony Hall, Sunday, April 14th at 3 p.m., celebrityseries.org. And Kind-Hearted Woman, Frontline and Independent Lens, present a film by David Sutherland. Follow one Sioux woman seeking to overcome abuse and heal her family. Kind-Hearted Woman continues Tuesday at 9 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Now it is your turn at 877-301-8970. You know that old saying, a penny saved, 2.5 pennies earned? It's actually not quite like that. But in a piece by former New Hampshire Senator John Sununu, he makes the point that that's what it costs, 2.5 cents to manufacture a penny. And then he goes on to ask the question I think should have been asked for years. Is it time to just say goodbye to the penny? And we want to know what you think at 877-301-8970. I am amazed, Marjorie, beyond the cost. Again, 2.5 cents to manufacture a penny. That's number one. Number two, they weigh a lot in your pocket.
They do, Jim.
Number three.
Holes in your pockets.
When you go to a store and there's 17 cents change, do you take the 2 cents? You probably don't. You probably throw it in a little cup that's
Save
on the
pennies.
Thing. Yeah, they give them the pennies. The point is, it's almost a, it's the notion that everything has to be exact to the penny in this society is absurd. And I think John Sununu is onto something. It is time to get rid of the penny. It saves money for the federal budget, which is obviously a big deal. We're saving a ton of money. And secondly, it makes it easier for all of the rest of us in our normal monetary pursuits.
But you know, on the other hand, Jim, when you go into Dunkin' Donuts and you buy your coffee and you get change from that, a lot of it in pennies. You know, when the clerk isn't looking, you drop all those pennies in the change thing and make it sound like there's a lot going in there.
You mean the tip jar? I don't do that. 877-301-8970. I think it'd be a day of great joy in this country. Can anybody give us an argument at 877-301-8970? Make an argument for the penny. Actually, Stephen Colbert, now that I think about it, Stephen Colbert attempted to make an argument for the penny in favor of the penny. Here he is.
What kind of world would this be without the noble penny? What would we leave in the take a penny, leave a penny tray? And without pennies, will I have to offer a nickel for your thoughts? That's a 500% raise for the same amount of thinking. What will we drop off the Empire State Building to kill tourists?
877-301-8970. About once a week, we have a topic on this show where I really don't think there is another side. Sununu makes the point, former Senator Sununu, and I'm paraphrasing, the only people who would actually go out of their way to fight for the penny are the zinc manufacturers. The penny used to be copper.
I didn't even know
it
this.
It is now primarily zinc.
Did you know zinc? That it was zinc? I thought it was copper. Well, I didn't know it was zinc.
I think I knew it was some other thing. I didn't know it was zinc. But the bottom line is, other than the people who produce the zinc that goes into the penny, what constituency does the penny have?
Apparently Congress is very nervous about any changes to the currency, including getting rid of the penny.
But why? He says that. What is the nervousness
traditionalists, about? Traditionalists, they don't want to rock the boat. They're worried about any kind of modifications to currency or to change. They just get very queasy, Jim. And with the way things are going in Congress, I don't know if this is something that they can actually get together on.
Let's go to Kathy in Fairhaven. Is it time for the penny to just wave goodbye, Kathy? Hello.
Absolutely. And I have a solution for it.
What is it?
Round it up to the next nickel or dime. Take the difference and add it to the deficit. I mean, pay down the deficit with it.
I love that, actually.
Ooh,
that's clever.
There was a movie a few years ago, well, maybe like 10, I'm getting old, about Catherine Zeta-Jones was in it, and it was Kuala Lumpur, and the scheme was that at the stroke of midnight, they were going to just change the whole financial scheme by one penny worldwide, and it added up to billions of dollars, and it would never be noticed because it was just one penny on every person's account. So, I mean, these pennies can really add up.
No, I think the deficit reduction concept is a brilliant one, Kathy. We'll pass it on to those in charge. Thank you so much for the call. 877-301 89.70.
There were a lot of great little factoids in this article by Johnson & Noonan.
Mm-hmm. Like
at market prices, today's pennies, as you say, are mostly zinc, but the older ones are pure copper that were minted before 82, and they're worth more as scrap metal. But
it's illegal to melt them down,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's illegal to melt them down. And I didn't know there were all these rules. You can only take $5 worth of pennies can be carried out of the country. So I guess you can't take your pennies elsewhere and melt them down and try to cash in.
I don't want to get into it, but a number of my friends have been smuggling pennies across the border to melt them in Canada and reap a handsome profit, I should say.
Has Canada gotten rid of pennies? They have.
No. I think they have, actually.
I think they have. They gave in. Yeah.
Well, you know, there are a lot of advocates. I don't quite get the argument that say we should also get rid of the dollar bill. It costs a lot. Actually, paper bills cost a lot to produce. And we should have coins like they have in much of Europe, the euro and those kind of things.
The
so these beautiful kind of coins, get rid of the penny. 877-301-8970. Is there any advocate for continuation of the penny? Rick in Providence, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Rick.
Hi.
Hi.
So let's see. I'm against the penny. We have too many debts, too many spending money on things that make no sense. And it seems that the only advocates of the penny are the copper producers. I've read that they started some innocuous group like Freedom of Money or something like that. I don't know. And this is ridiculous. Our country is drowning in debt, and we have to keep attached onto these strange things that just cost money.
So if Marjorie and I, Rick, led a march on Washington to get rid of the penny, could we count on you to join us?
Sure, let's go.
We knew
I'm,
you could.
I'm driving right now. I'll see you there.
Rick, thanks for the call.
Suppose you see a penny on the sidewalk, Jim. Do you pick it up?
I'm sorry you brought that up. I do only, this is horrible to admit, I only do if it's heads up.
Oh, really?
If it's heads up, this is true. If it's tails showing, I do not pick up the penny.
And why is that?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no idea. And then, by the way, I don't know what I do with it. I just don't. I usually put it in a little compartment in my car.
I know what you do with it. I put pennies in my wallet. So if something is $4.77, I give the clerk 2 pennies. And then it's always a 50-50 shot whether they can give you, you know, figure it out without the,
you know,
without the machine.
In all seriousness,
I
can, other than picking up a penny off the ground for reasons of superstition that I don't quite understand, I literally have not taken a penny in change, even if it's 4 pennies, I would say in years.
By the way, the primary reason is for weight reasons.
It's not about tipping. Let's go to Karen in New Hampshire. You are next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the survival or lack of survival of the penny. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, guys. First, let me say I pick up the penny, too, because that old superstition that it's good luck to pick up a penny.
Good luck. Yeah, sure.
But actually, many years back, the show West Wing had a whole segment about somebody coming up with the idea of getting rid of the penny. Hmm. And Sam Seaborn was tasked with having to figure out why we couldn't do it. And ultimately, the reasons they determined was because, one, at the time, the majority leader of the Senate was from Illinois. And because it's got Lincoln's head on it, and that's an Illinois president, that was one reason not to get rid of it.
That's actually pretty good. I believe it. Go ahead, Karen.
And the other reason was because of the product that it was made of at the time was like copper and whatever, carried too many votes for the Democratic states. So they couldn't get rid of it because then they would lose votes when it came to
the copper producing case.
Because the re-election,
By the way, it's preposterous, Karen. Thanks for the call. That may sound on its face. I find it totally plausible. But since Karen just mentioned Illinois, here's John Green. He's the best-selling author and YouTube economist on why pennies are doomed. Listen up.
The only reason we have pennies is because people like pennies and they grew up with pennies and they like Abraham Lincoln. But let me tell you, if Abraham Lincoln were alive today, he would say, why is my face on a coin that is worth 1/26th of what a penny was worth when I was president?
That's the question he would ask. There's no question about that.
Stephen has just emailed.
What did he say?
He wants to know how we will let horrible waitresses know what we think of their service without the pennies.
Yeah, Stephen. Let's go to
Gerard and Newton. Hi,
thank you,
thanks for calling, Gerard.
Hi. Yeah, I'm very much in support of keeping the penny, just because, just in terms of materials. I mean, Congress is in charge of what the penny or any other coin is actually made of. So the Mint has to get approval from Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But you can change the size and you can change the material. You could make it out of aluminum, and you could make it much smaller, like a Eurocent. is much smaller than the penny.
Yeah, it is.
So
that's right.
You can cut that. You can cut down the cost in terms of manufacture much easier. And the biggest problem that I have with this is that it's inherently inflationary.
How so?
And any because if you have to eliminate the penny, then any producer has to either take the loss or round it up. And any producer is going to round up. They're not going to just take a loss. They're going to pass on the cost to whoever's the buyer at the end.
That's actually a decent point. Go ahead.
And any argument you're going to make for the penny, you also have to make for the nickel. Because the nickel, we lose more producing each nickel than we do for each penny. We lose several pennies for every nickel produced. So basically,
well, actually, before you continue, Gerard, Sununu takes it further. The last line in his piece today is a nickel costs 11 cents to produce. So there's a 6 cent, this is unbelievable, a 6 cent loss on every single nickel, Gerard.
Gerard, so you make a great point, though. There's a slippery slope here, right? You know, today
right,
the penny,
exactly.
Then the nickel, then the
and
dime.
The goal of this argument is to eliminate both the penny and the nickel, and that just makes it the only argument that you're making in terms of a government budget is in terms of signage, and you're not actually really doing the other job of money, which is supplying money supply to people. And the people that get hurt the most are the poorest people.
We got it, Gerard.
Okay, we
thank you for the call.
Gerard has changed my mind.
No, but he also...
No, I think the slippery slope, Jim, is very upsetting, too.
I think he makes the case for the barter system.
The quarter. I mean, the penny today, the nickel tomorrow, the dime in 10 years, Jim, and then they're after the quarter.
But by the way, do you know first they came for the penny, then they came
exactly.
for exactly. Let's actually keep going here. Let's go to Tom in Peterborough. You're on with Jim and Marjorie. We're discussing whether or not to dump the penny, and Marjorie has already changed her mind.
I've changed my mind.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks,
guys. I think that we actually need to get rid of the penny, but we also need to get rid of, and this is a little bit off subject, but at the gas pumps, the 9/10 of a charge... for a gallon.
That's great.
If we're talking about a penny, we don't actually have a 9/10 denomination. I mean, so what happens with that? It's the exact same thing in terms of getting rid of the penny. Get rid of the 9/10 at the pumps.
Tom, another brilliant argument.
Really, I
tell you, I haven't thought this through well enough, Jim. Apparently, thank you very much, Tom. Let's go to Jeff in Belmont. Are you with the penny, Jeff, or again the penny?
You know, rather than being so reactive here and always being behind the times, why don't we be proactive?
Okay.
Get rid of penny, nickel, dime, and then set a timeline for the elimination of the quarter.
Do you have something against quarters, all those laundry machines you had to lug the quarters to for all those years, Jeff? Or maybe it's the parking meter.
I still do see the value to the quarter. And in some small, quaint towns that actually take nickels and dimes in the parking meter.
Yes.
Like, I think, Watertown.
Brookline.
Which is a great
Brookline
joy.
Does, yeah, that's right.
Great joy. That's the only use I actually make of my nickels and dimes is in parking meters. So let's just be proactive here. Get rid of all of it.
Well, also, all parking meters that take change are going to be gone in a couple of years anyway. What they're being replaced by are the credit cards. We just slip your credit card in, you get a little ticket, you put it on your dash.
Yeah, but you have both.
End of discussion. Jeff, thank you for your thoughts. We appreciate it.
Let's go to Sue on the Massachusetts Turnpike. Are you with the penny, Sue, or against the penny?
I think we have to keep it. I like the idea of the fellow that said to make it cheaper, but I'm worried about the taxes because... right now it's 6.25, and would they go up to 10 or would they go down to 5%? Because, anybody who's collecting that tax, you have to collect it exactly. So.
Another brilliant point. Jim.
Well, it's actually not such a brilliant point.
They raised it up to 10%.
No, they
don't.
They don't change the tax at all. At the end, when they charge the tax, they decide where to round the figure. Sue, before I let you go, I mean, don't you find it oppressive, though, when you get a pocket full of pennies, it's weighing you down. You say to yourself, it's costing my government more money to make than its face value. Isn't that aggravating to you or no?
I'm not aggravated, but I have to say, what's wrong with government that they let that happen?
I could not agree more. The nickel costs 11 cents. The penny costs 2.5. It's a wonderful way to end it, Sue. Thank you for your call.
Don't you have one of those glass jars, Jim? That's where you put your pennies. You put the pennies in the glass jars, and then you go down to the supermarket and get the little penny things and get your money back. Have you ever done that?
In the words of John Kerry, Marjorie was against the penny before she was for it. Thankfully, that is it for today. We'll have to leave the penny issue totally unresolved. I want to thank everybody who joined us today. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. You can follow us on Twitter at Boss, B-O-S, Public Radio, and Facebook.com/BPR. Tomorrow, the editor of the Boston Globe joins us at 1 o'clock on Open Mic. That's Brian McGrory. He will talk about the Boston mayoral race. And by the way, State Representative Marty Walsh announced today that he is running during our show. He did that. He'll also talk about this devastating taxicab series. And then Joyce Kilhaywick and Jared Bowen will have the latest on stage and screen in Boston. I wouldn't miss it if I were you. We won't. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
See you tomorrow at noon. Thanks so much for being here.